It's an overview of the Administrative Services Department of Human Services. And Clyde?
Yes. Good morning.
Welcome. I understand you haven't done this in a while.
It's been about 7 years, so I'm a little rusty.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Rest me.
Yeah.
It was Representative Westland I was concerned about.
Yeah.
And with good reason, I might add. So please go ahead.
Thank you. Chairman Cruz and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Clyde Psyche, and I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the Department of Human Services. And I appreciate the opportunity to meet with the committee to provide an overview and answer any questions you may have about DHS Administrative Services. Today I plan on giving the committee an overview of administrative services, which includes a brief description of each office and the services they provide. I'll also talk about the efficiencies and cost control measures that have been gained through the administrative consolidation process and the challenges we face in the current budget situation. I know that the committee has a particular interest in the area of information technology, so I brought along our Chief Information Officer, John Cuddy, and he'll be making the presentation on our Office of Information Services. But I want to start this morning by saying that my daughter, Laura, who's a senior at South Salem High School, had the opportunity to testify before this committee earlier this session. She's a very perceptive person, and she noticed that while I was working on my presentation this weekend, I was a little nervous and anxious, again, because I haven't done this for about 7 years. So anyway, she asked me what I was doing, and I told her that I was preparing testimony for a legislative committee. So she then reminded me that, hey, Dad, I testified before a committee. And so then I told her, well, coincidentally, I will be testifying before the same committee that you did. And so she kind of thought about that for a minute, and then she looked at me and she said, well, Dad, I don't know what you're nervous about, because they were all really, really nice. So my hope is that when I go home tonight, I'll be able to report to her that she was indeed right and that the committee members are really, really nice.
Well, and I would point out that we probably are nicer to attractive young ladies.
Well, I told her the big difference is that I'm not the 17-year-old high school teacher. My circumstance will probably be a little different than hers was.
Fly, that little girl that... Was that your daughter? Was that your daughter from the peer mentor program?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she mentioned that she had talked to you, and actually I think she said she's talked to you, Representative Belto, on several occasions since.
She's great.
So, thank you. The department really first began the consolidation of administrative services in 1996 under then-director Gary Weeks. Prior to the consolidation, the department had separate administrative units for each of its 7 divisions. This meant that the department had 7 technology units, 7 contracting units, 7 human resources units, and so on. We had 1 administrative unit for each administrative function for each division. This also meant that we had 7 chief information officers, 7 chief financial officers, 7 heads of personnel, and so on. We also had 7 different sets of administrative policies and procedures, and this meant that an employee who worked for our old Adult and Family Services division used a different form and a different process to get their travel reimbursed than an employee in the old mental health division. We also had 7 different sets of personnel rules, which meant that an employee would be treated differently depending on where they worked in the department. Another advantage of consolidation has been the increased efficiency realized by consolidating our administrative units. Since 1996, this has allowed us to reduce our staffing in administrative services and has also allowed us to absorb additional workload without adding additional staff. The consolidation in 1996 was the first step in bringing consistency and standardization in the way administrative services was handled by the department. The administrative services cluster was formed in February of 2001 as part of the reorganization under then-director Bobby Mink. Administrative services was formed to increase efficiency, reduce unnecessary duplication, and reduce confusion for DHS staff, clients, providers, and contractors. For the first time in the department's history, the administrative services cluster brought a department-wide approach to the way we handle information services, human resources, financial services, contracts and purchasing, communication, facilities, and forms and document management. The mission of DHS Administrative Services is to support DHS through timely, accurate, effective, and consistent administrative systems. To help us achieve our mission, we have established 8 goals that you'll see listed on pages 1 and 2 of the handout. I would like to point out 3 of these goals that we think are particularly important. The first is the goal of implementing standardized business practices. Earlier in my presentation, I mentioned the fact that in the past we had 7 different travel reimbursement forms and 7 different processes, and this was neither cost-effective nor efficient. This meant that we had to maintain 7 different processes for the simple task of reimbursing our employees for travel. We have standardized this process and many more, and we now just have 1 process for reimbursing DHS staff for travel. While we agree that it's important to customize services to meet individual needs, we also believe that business services need to be standardized to achieve maximum efficiency and cost effectiveness. The second goal is to increase the efficiency, effectiveness, and coordination of administrative services through the consolidation of functions across the department. The consolidation of administrative services has allowed us to maximize our resources, better utilize our staff, and eliminate duplicative systems and processes. The third goal I want to mention is the development of department-wide policies and procedures to guide our administrative services. And also a key point to that is communicating these policies to staff. This has been an important initiative for us. And prior to consolidation, each division had their own set of administrative policies and processes. Again, this was frustrating and confusing for staff as well as all the providers, contractors, and vendors we dealt with. By implementing department-wide policies, we've reduced the frustration and confusion and also reduced staff time spent implementing and maintaining these separate policies. However, implementing new policies is pointless if we don't let our staff know what those new policies are. So we've developed a communication plan for all new policies and have a policy website that staff and the public can access, as well as providers and contractors. In developing these policies, we have clearly stated expectations for our staff and managers and have included the factor of staff accountability for the policies.
Can you give an example of conflicting policies? I guess each silo had policies based on their business activities where you would have had a conflict in policies between, for example, and I'm going to use old acronyms,
sure, right.
Okay, because I haven't learned all the new ones yet. Between SDSD and AFS sort of thing. I mean, because clearly they've still got to have kind of. So how do you merge something like that to where there's a uniform policy? Because it's clearly different functions.
Sure. I think one good example, Chairman Cruz, would be. A lot of policies we have around who gets to approve certain things that staff have to do, like purchases and contracts and those types of things. In some of the former divisions, you have to get 4 or 5 signatures to get a contract or a purchase order approved. And it probably, because of people being away from their desks, took you 3 weeks to approve a purchase order or a payment. And in the meantime, the vendor was waiting for that payment. What we've done is standardize those processes so that we have standard approval paths, and what we've tried to do is not over-regulate the approval of those kinds of things. We still have built in the accountability factor because we want to be good stewards of public funds, but having 4 or 5 people sign off to approve a $500 purchase order is really not a very efficient process.
Okay, you're talking administrative policies specifically here, not program policy at all.
Chairman Cruz, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
We have provided the committee with an organizational chart which includes FTE for each administrative services office. Our budget in 2001-03 is about 2.8% of the department's total budget and about 3.4% of the department's general fund budget.
Could you ask to repeat
this? Yeah. Repeat the figures, please.
Chairman Cruz, Representative Tomei, it's 2.8% of the department's total budget and 3.4% of the department's general fund budget, and that's for 01-03.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The services provided by the administrative services cluster are an important part of the business infrastructure of the department. And I liken these services to the infrastructure of a city or a town. Things like roads, water systems, bridges, and sewer systems are things we take for granted until we have a problem with them or until they're not working. We then realize how critical they are to the operation of our cities and towns. Likewise, a lot of the things we do in administrative services are taken for granted until there are problems where they don't work. For example, 80% of our budget goes out to communities in the form of payments to contractors, providers, and clients. Our accounting, contracts, and information systems facilitate the process of making those payments and drawing the federal funds for those payments. The services provided by the administrative services cluster, are part of the critical business infrastructure of DHS. On page 2 and 3 of the handout, there's a list of the offices within the administrative services cluster. And if there are no questions, what I'll do is give a brief overview of each office.
That'll be fine.
The first office is the Office of Financial Services, and they provide accounting, payroll, and collection services for the department. On page 2 of the handout, you'll find the financial services mission statement and goals. Under the goals, I want to point out the goal of maximizing collections of monies owed to the department. The financial recovery section in financial services is responsible for collections that generate revenue for the department. And I'll provide you more information that in just a little bit as I get further into the presentation.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Clyde, I don't see a unit that talks about like loss prevention or controlling costs. Maybe that's in the contracts and procurement section, but I hope you'll speak a little bit to how the department protects itself from abuses of resources, people writing checks to themselves, caseworkers taking advantage of the system. So I hope you'll include that in your overview.
Representative Cruz and Representative Beltel, I will speak to that, but if I forget, please remind me.
Sure.
And I'll
Thank
address
you.
That. The accounting section of financial services provides a wide range of accounting functions for the department. This includes making payments to vendors and providers, reconciling financial statements, travel reimbursement, and receiving payments that are made to the department. This section is also responsible for federal fiscal reporting and management of the department's cost allocation plan. These two functions are a critical piece of the process of accessing federal funds that support our programs. Our payroll section is responsible for preparing and dispersing paychecks and tracking leave balances. They also assist staff with time reporting and answer questions on employee benefits.
Could we back up just a minute to the 215 federal reports each quarter? It's amazing. It would be interesting to know how many of those are Medicaid, how many Medicare, SSI, food stamps, that sort of thing. And on the Medicaid ones, how many of them are driven by waivers? I mean, if you can do that sort of thing. The reason for that ask is quite simply we think that when we're trying to streamline the health plan and things like that, that maybe we need to work with the federal government on seeing if we can get them to streamline as well. So,
Representative Cruz, I don't have that information with me, but I can certainly get a breakdown and work with Lisa to get that.
I think Lisa wrote it down.
Great.
Just as an aside, I mean, that's 3+ reports every working day, if you take the weekends out, that they have to do.
Representative Cruz and Representative Westland. And I think the other factor we look at is that oftentimes with the reporting requirements, we also pass that requirement down to some of our contractors on the county level, and that I understandably so creates an additional burden on them also. So right. There's kind of a ripple effect of all those reports also.
Go ahead. That's jumped out of Sandy, and I'm glad it did. That's an amazing thing. But go ahead.
Well, Representative Cruz, I think one of the I don't want to say drawbacks because we appreciate all the federal funds we get, but it seems that any time we get federal funds, we have 2 or 3 reports to account for how we use them. So it's.
You'd think they'd trust us.
This is our funds. We pay them.
The financial recovery section is the revenue generating section I mentioned earlier. The units in this section make collections for things like overpayment of food stamp benefits and overpayments to providers. In the handout, there's a list on pages 4 and 5 of the units along with the projected collection amounts for the current biennium. For the current biennium, we are projecting that these units will collect over $49 million, which when you break it down by the FTE we have working there, is a collection rate of about $830,000 per person.
Representative Westland, you could probably ask the same question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Clyde, in the medical payment recovery, third-party payer, could we get a tracking of that over the last couple bienniums, how that has tracked, and then how are you doing with actuals as opposed to your projection, the 17.3 collection? And then do you happen to know off the top of your head, third question, how much we appropriate for the medical payment recovery department?
Chairman,
how much do we spend to get this 17?
Yeah, Chairman Cruz, Representative Westland, I don't have that information right off the top of my head, but it's something that we can easily put together and get back to you in a very short time.
That'd be great.
And we'd be happy to do that.
It might also include the institutional revenue.
Chair Cruz. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
So much. This is all new to me, this financial recovery. Could we spend a few more minutes just sort of explaining what do you mean by recovery?
Chair Cruz and Representative Tomei, what happens is that we have staff who actually work at collecting overpayments from clients in areas like food stamp. In other words, when we make an overpayment in food stamp benefits, their job is to determine what the overpayment was and then determine how they're going to a collection method. We also have and I must apologize, but I'm not a real expert in this area. This is one of the areas where we really just consolidated them probably about a year and a half ago, so they're fairly new to the cluster. And what we decided to do is that we had all these separate recovery units, but they were spread throughout the department. And what we found or what we anticipated is that by moving them together, we'd have better coordination, better communication, and then be able to maximize our payments more than when they were separate entities. But another example, just in my limited knowledge, is if we make a health plan payment for a client and then we find out that the client or person indeed had private medical insurance, then we would try to recover the money that the health plan paid for services from that third-party insurer.
And my follow-up. So you get almost $50 million a year from these
Representative
activities?
Chair Cruz, excuse me, and Representative Tomei, that's what we're projecting to collect for this biennium.
Amazing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Clyde, in the medical payment recovery, Now, have you removed that from OMAP, or are you overseeing OMAP's? Because OMAP did do the collections, and they are no longer doing those collections. That function has been moved into the administrative services completely, or how is that connected?
Yeah, Chairman Cruz, I believe that's correct. We still work very closely with the OMAP staff, but the actual function, or the collection function, has been moved into administrative services.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you are recovering for, say, food stamps or TANF, is this an eligibility problem that people tell you things that aren't really true, or we assume that they're in need and give more than they should have had? Tell me a little bit about that.
Chairman Cruz and Representative Anderson, my understanding, and if it's not correct, I will certainly get back to you, is that overpayments are made because of incorrect information that's given while we're determining eligibility. The one thing I'm not sure about is whether or not, if the error is our fault, whether we also seek repayment of those funds. But I can find that out for you and get back to you, please. Oh, okay. John also reminded me that there are situations when something changes in the household and people are ineligible and we continue to pay benefits because they've delayed in telling us this situation has changed, and so now they would be ineligible for benefits.
Follow-up, please?
Yes.
How would you know that? How would that information get to you?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, I would have to get back to them. And like I say, this is an area that's fairly new to administrative services, and so I'm not as well versed in this area as others. But I think that we'll get back to you on that.
Thank you.
Well, Representative, for example, if somebody's on the Oregon Health Plan and they do have third-party insurance, that information is discoverable on a couple different websites. So that would be one way to find that out. Mm-hmm.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could, I mean, this is a big deal in terms of the stuff that both our committees, I kind of tend to think of them as one committee anymore, is looking at. I mean, you think of a patient comes to the office, Oregon Health Plan patient, he's sick. I mean, all he or she wants is treatment. You know, Oregon Health Plan, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, any other coverage, they might not even know. Mm-hmm. The strange as that might seem. And then even if they're as forthright as they can be, you know, they give, well, it's, you know, Blue Cross and it's really Blue Shield, and just their ability to go back and track and find this, it's a very cumbersome, very awkward, very time-consuming, very expensive process, and yet that's money that's actually owed to the state. And the line of questioning, obviously, is generated, you know, to get those additional resources so we can provide additional coverage and benefits. And this is a big deal.
And it's not only to get them, but if we can get them on the front end rather than chasing the tail, we have the use of that money. So it is a significant deal. That's a technical term.
I try to speak in single syllable words. For the benefit of the chair.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
So the primary challenge we face in this area is further reductions of staff due to the current budget climate. This is especially troublesome in the financial recovery section, where we feel reductions in staff would lead to a reduction in the revenue we're able to collect for the department. We're also concerned about staff reductions in units that are responsible for performing the functions that allow us to maximize and draw down federal revenues. And in other areas, staff reductions would mean delays to vendors, delays in vendor payments, and that's not a very desirable outcome either for us. I'd like to move on to the Office of Contracts and Procurement, and that begins on page 6. This office is responsible for the department's contracting and purchasing functions. As I said earlier, approximately 80% of our budget goes out to local communities for client benefits and services and payments to providers and vendors. and the primary vehicle for making these disbursements are contracts. In a typical biennium, this unit writes and processes close to 10,000 contracts and amendments to assist with the disbursement of these funds. Consolidating these functions has led to standardization and consistency in the processes in contracting and purchasing. One of the changes we've instituted is the development of a department-wide template for contracts. In the past, if you were a contractor and contracted with more than one DHS division, you would receive contracts that contained different sets of terms and conditions. This meant that you would have to enter into separate negotiations with each division you contracted with around the terms and conditions of the contract. Development of the department template has led to less negotiating time and quicker processing times for contracts. The consolidation has also increased our ability to make purchases as a department rather than seven separate divisions. This allows us to better utilize price agreements and price breaks and leads to increased savings for the department. An example of the efficiencies we've gained in this area are copiers. Since the consolidation, we have centralized the management of copiers and anticipate that in this current biennium, we will reduce our copying expenditures by about $240,000.
Wow. By doing what?
By centralizing the management of copiers. I don't want to air dirty laundry, but in the past, if we had a building, let's say, in John Day, which might not be a good example, but it's one I'll use. Let's say we had an AFS, an SCF, and an SDSD, using the old acronyms, office in there. Each division would have their own copier. And since we've centralized the management, we've gone back in and said, you really don't need three copiers. You could probably make do with one or one good-sized copier and a smaller copier. And we are undergoing that process throughout the entire organization. And amazingly enough, we also anticipate that we're going to find quite a bit of savings in fax machines and the mail equipment we have out there, because in the past we've kind of had the same philosophy that each division had to have their own equipment.
No wonder Bill Witt moved to Seattle.
is part of the efficiencies and this maybe gets into IT a little bit, but are we trying to see how much information we can do paperless at this point? I mean, for example, if you need hard documents, that's one thing, but an email rather than a fax, that sort of thing. So,
Chairman Cruz, I think there's several areas where we're looking at that. One of them is in our communication section, where we've centralized the management of our website. And what we're trying to do a lot of times is provide people with information over the web. And I'll speak to that a little later. Also, when we get to forms and document management, I'll talk about some of the work they're doing in trying to move systems to a paperless electronic system in processing, which really results, I think, in some efficiencies and gains. One, two ways to save it. Yeah.
John, if you just want to sit there with him, you can do that.
I'm up here.
That's why we have the extra chairs.
He needs his exercise.
Are we being nice so far?
I think my daughter would be extremely happy. And I will actually have to have her come back here and thank the committee for me.
Being nice.
Representative Tomei.
I just want to point out on page 7 that they write and process nearly 10,000 contracts each biennium. That's just amazing.
Now, when you 10,000 contracts, that isn't provider contracts, is it, or is it?
Representative Cruz and Representative Tomei, it's contracts for everything we would contract for. It would also mean IT contracts. It would mean contracts for consulting services in certain areas. And I do want to clarify that it's 10,000 contracts and amendments. So it's not just 10,000 straight contracts, because in a lot of cases we have amendments to contracts which precludes us from having to rewrite the whole contract over again.
So, if you're like the contract you have with AAA in Douglas County, that's one of the contracts that will be written here.
Chairman Cruz, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Chairman Cruz and Representative Tomei, I used to manage that unit at one time, and I would agree with you.
Okay.
This is one of the offices whose workload has actually increased in the current budget environment. Budget reductions or restorations usually lead to a change in contracts associated with the service that's being restored or reduced. So this unit has spent many hours in the past month amending and terminating contracts for services that have been impacted by the reductions. And we will now begin to amend and reinstate contracts for services that have been restored by the latest legislative action.
As you're going through this, I just thought, and I'm not sure it's relevant, but it may be. I mean, clearly there's connections in some of these things to what goes on in DAS. So, I mean, if there are clear connections, I mean, and the reason I brought that up, you're talking about termination. Some of the letters on termination came out of DAS, not out of Human Services, and so that connection might be worthwhile to know about too. So Lisa and I had a conversation about that.
So. Chairman Cruz, that's very true. And another big partner, especially in the area of contracting that we work with, is the Department of Justice. So they're also someone who we work very closely with to get these contracts and amendments done. Budgetary reductions in this area would increase the time it takes to execute grants and contracts, and this may lead to delays in implementing programs that provide services to clients and the public. I'd like to move on now to the Office of Communication, and their overview begins on page 8. Communication is a complex and essential task in an organization as large as complex as DHS, with its diverse workforce of over 9,000 employees and its many partners and stakeholders. When things go wrong in any organization, it's often because of a communication issue. It may be that the communication has not been timely, or has not been accurate, or is not clearly understood by the intended audience. So communication is particularly important for us at DHS now as we undergo major internal change and as financial difficulties force reductions in services to thousands of Oregonians. One of the areas of responsibility for this office is media relations. These are the people who coordinate news conferences, write news releases, schedule editorial briefings, and respond to requests for information by the news media and the public. This is one area where we have been able to achieve major efficiencies in consolidation. Prior to consolidation, each division had a media relations staff person. Since the consolidation, we've been able to reduce the number of media relations staff from 7 to 3. So we currently have 3 people doing media relations, where previously we had 7.
Well, and it shows because people are mad at you now.
Representative Cruz, I think even if we increase that number, people would still be mad at us.
I know, that was a very weak attempt at humor.
Oh, that was a joke. Oh.
Another primary area of work for this office is maintaining and managing the DHS website. The web, we feel, is an important tool for providing information to clients, providers, staff, and the public. During the past 12 months, our websites have received over 5 million hits.
Wow.
Yeah, I thought that was an amazing figure.
Yeah, most of those were Sandy.
Yeah, okay.
I hate you guys a lot.
DHS recently launched a single integrated website, bringing together information that was previously dispersed across 10 websites in the former DHS divisions. The new site is organized by topic area rather than by the department's organizational structure, and is easier for clients and the public to navigate. greater utilization of the website has allowed us to provide more timely information and also has helped us to reduce printing costs. Further reductions in this area would hamper our ability to provide timely and accurate information to staff, clients, providers, and the public. On to facilities, and the overview for the Office of Facilities begins on page 10. This office is responsible for managing the 250 offices we have throughout the state. This includes the Human Services Building in Salem and the Portland State Office Building. Prior to consolidation, each DHS division had a facilities management section. This meant that when we were planning a new facility in a community, each division that would have staff in that facility assigned a facilities project manager to the project. For instance, if we had a building we were planning in Medford that the former AFS, SCF, VRD, and SDSD were going to be in, they would each send a project manager to Medford to meet with local staff to plan the facility. This was neither efficient nor cost-effective, in my view. In our current structure, we assign one project manager to each facility. So if we are planning a building in Medford, we have one project manager who is responsible for coordinating and meeting the business needs of all the clusters that will be going into that facility. The consolidation has allowed us to eliminate six project manager positions and also significantly reduce our travel costs. A reduction in funding in this area would reduce our ability to provide those planning services, and responsibility for planning new facilities will fall largely to our field staff and would take time away that would be better spent providing services to clients.
Do you have, you say it manages the department's fleet of vehicles, do you have vehicles that are the department's outside of the motor pool?
Chairman Cruz, we have permanently assigned vehicles, but they are motor pool vehicles.
Right. So that's the budget that they're in?
Yes.
Okay.
And I could also get you some figures. During the past 2 years, we've significantly reduced the amount of vehicles we have in our offices also.
Okay. Just as an aside, you're always... And it seems to happen in Southern Oregon a lot where you're looking at building a new building or, see, it was in Roseburg and then last one was in Klamath Falls. And, you know, I mean, it's a kind of moratorium on that sort of activity for the time being, or are we still looking at new facilities or consolidated facilities, or what's the status of that sort of thing at the moment?
Chairman Cruz, we are looking very carefully at every facility we are in where the lease is expiring, and our approach is to try to take the most cost-effective means possible to house our staff. In some cases, that means staying in our current locations. In other cases, we actually have landlords who, because the state is a desirable tenant, will give us leases that are comparable to or even in some cases better than our existing leases. So what's driving our facilities planning right now is what's the cost and what's the most cost-effective way to house our staff in that location. I think that one of the things that our director, Jean Thorne, wants to do is she really kind of wants to take a step back from where we have gone in the last year during reorganization and assess what's working, what's not working, what do we want to continue, and what do we want to stop doing. And so what we're trying to do in facilities also is arrange things so that we can afford her that luxury in the facilities area also.
Okay, I mean, I know one of the drivers in reorg was the one-stop shopping concept, but I think to a degree that needs to take a back seat to cost effectiveness at this point in time. So.
Right. And Chairman Cruz, at one point in time, I probably shouldn't say that because I sound like a job hopper. I supervised the facilities unit also. And co-location, I'm a strong believer that co-location does not mean service integration. And you can have people co-located and still not have an integrated service delivery system. So my philosophy when I was facilities manager was, let's talk about how you want to deliver services, and we'll build the facility around that, as opposed to let's build a facility, move you in there, and then you figure out how you're going to deliver services to clients, which I always felt was kind of the backwards approach to take.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Recently, I'm impressed that the department was trying to take existing buildings and retrofit them, especially in the downtown areas of some of the smaller cities. Is that still your policy?
Chairman Cruz and Representative Anderson, pursuant with the governor's executive order on sustainability, the previous governor's orders on sustainability, that's always the first option we look at.
Good plan.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dalto.
Thank you, Mr.
Do you have any courtesies today, or are we saving those for Friday?
The freshman hazing.
No, that's just Dalto hazing.
Now I've become distracted because I've been barraged by my colleagues. I believe my... Well, I don't remember.
Well, Chairman Cruz and Representative Dalto, I would be happy to entertain the question when it comes back to you.
Did it reappear?
Yeah, funny dye tape material for sure, right there.
And Chairman Cruz and Representative Dalto, you could also call me in my office if it doesn't appear during the course of this hearing.
You get older now.
My question. Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Representative Paul.
Thank you so much. My question is this: I've seen DHS do wonderful things in rehabilitating buildings, or having landlords rehabilitate, existing buildings, and then move in, have DHS move into those buildings with their field offices. And my question is: does it cost more to take an existing building and kind of retrofit it and then have a DHS office move in? In other words, is it costing more to move into those sustainable buildings, in your experience?
Chairman Cruz and Representative Dalto, it really depends on the age of the building, because as you go in and retrofit, if the building is of a certain age, we have to go in when we retrofit and bring the building up to code. And in some cases, that's a substantial investment to make, and in some cases it is cheaper in the short term to build to suit instead of retrofitting. But I think there's also some other things that we need to look at as to, again, I think the sustainability issue, which is very important. And if we have opportunities to go into vacant buildings, I think that's always a better strategy than having these buildings already exist vacant in some of these areas.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Anderson.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. I think I picked up on you saying that you don't think that necessarily everybody has to be in one location. Is that a function of information technology, where you can be different locations and yet tied together quite closely?
Chairman Cruz and Representative Anderson, I think at this point in time, it's a lot more feasible to have people communicate electronically because of the way our information systems are than it was even 5 years ago, John. Mm. And so that certainly is one of the factors. I'd like to move on to the Office of Forms and Document Management, which is our newest office, and they provide a wide array of services in the area of document management, both hard copy and electronic. This includes assisting department staff with forms development, printing, and distribution. They also are responsible for the language translation of our forms and producing forms in alternate formats like Braille and large print. The unit is also responsible for entering Medicaid provider claims into our systems, The unit enters an average of about 128,000 claims a month from dentists, medical providers, hospitals, nursing homes, and other Medicaid providers. This office is also taking a lead role in converting the Oregon Health Plan application process from a paper-driven hard copy process to an electronic process. And one of the figures I got from the people in that unit is that OHP application and the OHP application and redetermination process generates over 400,000 pieces of paper because applications are multiple pieces of paper along with the supporting documentation each month. And we think that converting this process to an electronic process will increase efficiency and allow us to do the things we do now with less staff.
Is there going to be an attempt made to align the OHP forms with the Medicaid forms so that one form fits both? We had a conversation a couple of years ago about that and Medicare because, I mean, clearly we can't force folks to go to one form, but all three forms ask for basically the same sort of information.
Sure.
And what we heard out, especially at rural hospitals where they don't have a lot of administrative staff, is, you know, this triplication of information. Mm-hmm. Is kind of a burden, and so while we're reinventing here, I'm hoping that's something we're taking a hard look at, see if we can. If you're OHP, you're Medicaid, right. So it should be the same form,
right.
Sort of thing.
Chairman Cruz, I'm not aware of any specific efforts, but I'll check with you. And we certainly agree with you that, and that's something we're trying to do internally, is really kind of say. And John's unit is involved in this effort as we move more towards electronic application process and storage of data is there are certain pieces of information that no matter where you go for services are going to be consistent. And
right.
Can we set up a system so that clients can just give us that information once instead of five or six different times?
Okay, so I'm assuming, John, what we'd be looking at is the data is entered and then whatever... wherever it needs to go, it just goes and plugs in.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. It'll be lovely when we get there, won't it?
Years from now.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
So this is an office where process improvement and some electronic conversion has also allowed us to make major gains in efficiencies. Since this office was formed in 2002, we've been able to reduce our staffing level from 53 positions to 37 positions and still be able to handle the same volume of work. Further reductions in this area could lead to delays in provider payments, longer processing time for health plan clients, and delays in providing forms for clients who need them in an alternate format or a language other than English. The last office I'll speak about today is our Office of Human Resources, or our personnel shop. Some people are more familiar with personnel than human resources. And they're responsible for all our personnel-related functions. This includes all our labor relations work, recruitment and retention of staff, compensation and classification, affirmative action, and safety and health, including management of our workers' comp claims. This office is also responsible for negotiating the 6 labor contracts that we have within the department. And the largest of these contracts is with the State Employees International Union, SEIU. And they have 6,600 members approximately in DHS. Consolidation of our human resources functions has allowed us to streamline the SEIU contract so that DHS employees will receive the same treatment regardless of the cluster they work in. We're also projecting that the consistency of the new contract could lead to a reduction in grievances and arbitrations, which would be a cost saving for the department. Consolidation has also allowed us to develop one set of human resource policies. This allows us to maximize our resources by shifting staff to meet changing workload needs. In the past, each division had their own sets of personnel policies and procedures. This meant that human resources staff had to learn a specific division's sets of policies and procedures before they could provide human resource services to that division. The different policies and procedures were also confusing for our staff. two employees who may be sitting, who may have been sitting right next to each other, could have had different rights, expectations, and processes that they had to follow.
Can I ask about the incredible number of criminal record checks? I mean, clearly you don't do a criminal record check on each employee every year. You do it upon entry, and I'm assuming you don't need to after that. So what you're saying is between turnover and are those all mandatory record checks or not?
Chirby Cruz, the criminal record checks that this unit provides includes providers,
right,
volunteers, and staff. And in some cases, there is a statute or rule that requires us to perform criminal record checks, especially for employees who are going to be working unsupervised with vulnerable clients. People like our client-employed providers, the people who work in group homes. I believe we check people who work in nursing homes. And that's kind of the population we check.
I mean, do you actually do the check, or do you farm that out?
Chairman Cruz, we actually do the state check, which is called the LEDS check.
Right.
And with DHS staff, and then if it reaches a certain threshold, then we do an FBI, a national check. Things like if they haven't lived in state. Exactly. Exactly. If you haven't lived in the state, you've only been in the state for a year. I forget what the year threshold is, but you have to be in the state a certain time period before we won't do a national check. Or LEDS typically will give you a message that says multi-state offender on the bottom of the check, but that's all they'll give you. They won't tell you what the offense was and when it was, and so that's why we do the FBI check.
Kick in the FBI.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. How easy would it be to for you to give us the overall numbers for this? What is the actual budget for administrative services? Then in each box, how much goes to personnel and how much goes to operations? Is that fairly easy or not?
Chairman Cruz and Representative Mons Anderson, one of the things we struggle with during this current biennium is trying to work in two different roles, the old divisional structure, which is how our funding was allocated, and then our new organizational structure.
It was his fault.
Well, it's made it challenging. So I could probably provide you with some level of information and would be happy to do that, with the caveat that there are things that may be out of sync just because of the difficulty in living in two worlds at this point in time.
Mr. Chair, can I expand down that a little bit? Seems how it was my fault.
It was your fault, then you should have a chance to rebut. Go ahead.
I think what Clyde's alluding to, I think he understated the difficulty and the severity of the problem, because when we did the reorg and you took all these different budgeting silos and compressed them into as what we now call clusters, you're not comparing apples and oranges.
No,
you're comparing apples and pineapples, and sometimes they go to do their runs and the whole budget report just prints out zero, zero,
yeah,
zero, 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 and trying to get one set of data to compute and talk to the new requirement in the new cluster is extraordinarily difficult. And
mm-hmm.
So your question, legitimate as it is, and simple as it is, understandable as it is, mm-hmm. and this has to be done anyway. I mean, at some juncture,
you will get there.
We'll get there. But in terms of, and then you put that on top of all the special sessions, you put that on top of what we're going to do in a reorg come April, and then trying to go into 0305, mm-hmm. The department has really done yeoman's work in trying to get this transition completed. not to mention the fact that we're cutting their budgets as we go. So,
And we have tried to get runs, and it's really nobody's fault. It's just we picked the wrong year to do this.
Chairman Cruz and Representative Westland, thank you for articulating that much more eloquently than I did, and I know that when I get back, our budget and accounting people will take me into the room and probably browbeat me for understating the difficulty of the task they face in this biennium. And it really is, as Representative Westland said, it's a gigantic puzzle, and I don't know if there's it's one of these puzzles where there's all the pieces are the same color and they're all the same shape.
I hate those type of puzzles.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. In the Office of Human Resources, this is one area where workload has also increased with the budget reduction. So these are the people who are responsible for managing our staff layoff process. It's a very labor-intensive process, requires a high degree of coordination, tracking, and communication. Research and experience also tell us that increased stress and anxiety in the workplace may lead to an increase in the kinds of issues that our human resources people will have to resolve for our workforce. There are two other issues I want to touch on briefly before John has a chance to make his presentation. And the first is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA. Yeah. Information on this program is provided to you on pages 17 and 18 of the handout. HIPAA was an act that was passed by Congress in 1996 and provides safeguards for personal health information from disclosure, fraud, and abuse. It also gives people choices about who can access their personal health information. Implementation of the HIPAA rule requires significant changes in technology and business processes, and that has a direct effect on our staff, clients, providers, and local partners. HIPAA is a federal law, and noncompliance could potentially jeopardize the estimated $3.3 billion in Medicaid funds that we access. The law consists of many parts, but there are three parts that primarily affect DHS, and these are privacy, transactions, and codes, and securities. So very quickly, privacy. The deadline for implementation of the privacy provision is April 14, 2003, and right now we have completed the work to meet the deadline for implementation of the privacy rule.
How are you coordinating with docs and hospitals on this?
Chairman Cruz, we meet monthly with docs, hospitals, and I believe attorneys. To coordinate and talk about what the issues are. And we also coordinate very closely with our stakeholder groups, which are county governments and those types of people. So they know what we're doing and where we're going with this.
Okay. OMA said that it was going to cost $100 million for the state of Oregon to reach compliance. Is your cost, I'm assuming, is part of that figure? So that's public and private?
Yeah, Chairman Cruz, I believe so.
Okay. Westland.
Oh, excuse me.
Clyde, do you have any idea what this additional accountability, if you will, is going to cost the department in terms of man hour? Do you have any back of the envelope guess?
Chairman Cruz, Representative Westland, I really don't, but I could probably get our HIPAA program people to put that together for you. We do know it's going to have an impact in the amount of time. I mean, that's a given. How much would really be the kind of the question. And one of the things we've seen is that when they originally came out with rules like the privacy rules, they had things like your screen, computer screen, could not be visible from the aisleway.
Yeah.
And since that time, I think the federal government has kind of relented on some of those requirements and maybe taken a more common sense approach to some of the things that they were demanding that states do.
If you could just get, a back of the envelope wag type of thing, asking one question, what do you guess this thing is going to cost the department in terms of additional administrative time? Don't do any research.
Sure. No, Chairman Cruz, Representative Westland, I'm sure we could get that pretty easily, and I'll have our HIPAA program people put something together for you.
I think HIPAA is a good example of doing something by administrative rule, then fully vetting it through a legislative process sometimes doesn't always get the best results, but that's my personal opinion.
Yeah. We, Chairman Cruz, we like to call it an unfunded mandate, although the federal government does provide matching funds, but if you don't have the general fund to draw on the matching fund, then no, you're stuck. Quickly, the Transactions and Codes Act. HIPAA requires national uniform transactions and codes for the electronic exchange of information. We applied for and received an extension, and so our current compliance deadline is October 16, 2003. Right now the project plan is on target to meet this deadline, and we anticipate that we will have 80% of the works completed by the end of this biennium. Security rule. The final HIPAA security rule was promulgated in February, just this past February, and we have 2 years now to implement the rule. And what we're going to do is roll the HIPAA security requirements into our larger information security initiative in the department, and it'll just become part of that initiative, which I'll talk about next.
Is that a whole lot different than where you were going anyway? Other than it may be different tweaky things, but I mean, we're kind of going there anyway.
Yeah.
So this is HIPAA heading in the direction we were already going. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And Chairman Cruz, when you look at some of the things HIPAA will require as well as some of the other requirements we need to meet, it really kind of blends together very nicely.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Point out on page 18. That they're looking at 18 major information systems requiring 150,000 hours of work. Incredible figures.
Yeah, Chairman Cruz and Representative Tomei and John will speak more to that in his part of the presentation.
I guess I will.
Now you will.
He wasn't going to, but now he will.
Yeah.
At $6.50 an hour, that's going to cost us $1 million.
The one issue we have with HIPAA is that we did receive some general fund to access the federal matching funds for this biennium. We have not, or we're not able to get an allotment for HIPAA for next biennium, so we're in the process now of figuring out how we're going to fund the remaining work for 2003.
Is that a one-to-one match? 2-to-1, what is it?
It's, I believe, for development. Is it still 90-10?
It's
90-10.
Yeah, 90-10 for the Medicaid, and then for the other HIPAA, it's, well, some of it is 75-25, two parts of that.
Well, hell, that's better than we're getting anywhere else.
Yeah.
How big's the pot for federal dollars? Is it unlimited?
Yeah. As long as we come up with a match, the general fund piece of it, we can draw it
drugs
down.
With that money.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, no, we should designate eligibles in the health plan as HIPAA employees.
Okay, creative.
Let's go home.
Yeah.
Go home.
Well, I think that's something we need to take a look at. If we're leaving that kind of match money on the table, that's somewhat short-sighted. If it's something we're going to have to do anyway, so.
Yeah. And then the last piece I would just want to mention is our efforts around information security. And there are a lot of things that are driving the need to increase security. They include HIPAA, federal rules and regulations, some Secretary of State audit findings that we are responding to, as well as our own personal assessment. And really, I guess my approach is it's the right thing to do. We need to make sure that our systems and the confidential information is protected.
I just comment on the audit. I didn't see a whole lot of glaring anythings in there myself. So, I thought it was reasonable, and your responses were reasonable.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairman Cruz. And Chairman Cruz and Representative Dalto, getting back to the question you asked, since we've consolidated, what we've done is we've created a strong partnership with our own internal audit unit, and working in partnership with them, we have started identifying areas where we think we're at risk, and we're having the auditors go in and audit those programs to help us identify the risks. And then any program or administrative services office that has a piece of that process then works together to put safeguards in place to prevent it. And we're trying to be proactive, not just when we have an incident, go out and try to react to it, but we're also trying to go out ahead of time before an incident happens to assess risk and put things in place to minimize or reduce the risk.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dalto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Clyde, I'm looking at your FTE in the project management team section, and I see that you have three people handling HIPAA and information technology security and the other items. I mean, how much time do you have an FTE devoted to working on this information technology security?
Chairman Cruz and Representative Dalto, we have one FTE devoted to that project.
So we're trying to be proactive, but we have one person sort of moving in that direction. I mean, I look over at the information services section where they do the work of mm-hmm. networks and computers and technology, and you have 397 people in that department, mm-hmm. and you have one person overseeing the security of those 397 people. I guess it doesn't seem like there's enough support there.
Chairman Cruz and Representative Dalto, information security, this is actually a fairly new position and is not an area that we have been as diligent about as we probably should have been in the past. And really kind of our approach at this point in time is we've brought this one person in. This one person is charged with the responsibility of determining or developing a strategic plan on how we get there. And included with that plan will be what are the resources, staff, or otherwise that we need to implement that plan. And so at this point in time, what I want to say is that one person we have working in that area is really the person who's coordinating the planning effort in telling us what we need to do and how much resource we need to implement the changes that need to be implemented.
Well, I guess I'm wondering, because I'm assuming, you know, like you got HIPAA in there, but the bulk of the work's happening in John's shop, I'm assuming.
Yes.
So what you probably should have done was connected that box down to information services. And mm-hmm. yeah.
Well, Chairman Cruz, I think in keeping with Director Thorne's strategy, administrative services will certainly not be held harmless in the relook as to, in our current organizational structure, what's working, what's not, and are there things that make better sense in the long term. So we will certainly be also part of that review.
Yeah, but in answer to Representative Dalton's question, yeah, those three people aren't doing all that work. You know?
Sure.
It's happening
sure.
in information services.
That's true.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dalton.
And so how did the department respond to the incident where you had a caseworker stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars of funds by writing benefit checks to themselves?
Chairman Cruz and Representative Dalto, we sent a team in to assess the situation. Our HR people handled all the HR pieces and as well as coordinated the criminal investigation. Our financial services people did a review of the management checks and balances that were in place in that branch and how did an assessment of how the person was able to do that. And I'm not sure we're talking about the same one, but typically what we find out is that in a lot of these instances, it's a management control issue where we actually had policy or systems in place, but managers, for whatever reason, workload or incompetence or whatever, really had systems in place to help them address it, but didn't. And so what that leads to is an HR issue. But to further elaborate, our financial services people then will go in and do an evaluation and say, were the systems there? What is there anything we need to improve or change? The IS people are part of that team, and they go in and look and say, are there some system security issues around that where the person was able to bypass system security and just off the top of my head, those are just kind of the main people we send in to look at that. And then in the debrief, we talk about management controls, policy. Do we need more policy? Do we need to improve systems?
The case I was referring to was reported in the paper, I think, last summer. But how did you find out about it? Do you know the case I'm referring to?
Chairman Cruz and Representative Dalto, I believe it's a case that occurred on the coast in Tillamook, I believe.
I have the article in my office.
Right. And it pains me to say this, but we found out about it by accident. And that's, I think, a clear message to us that we have work to do and we need to get systems in place and really deal with those issues.
Can you elaborate more than by accident?
Chairman Cruz and Representative Dalto, I believe the person who was perpetrating the fraud went on vacation, and the person who was backing that person up, and again, this is just kind of the knowledge I have of the situation, the person who was backing that person up noticed some irregularities and took those to her manager.
Well, Mr. Chair, so given this irregularity and given the understanding of how this loss occurred, has the agency taken steps to prevent the same theft in the future?
Chairman Cruz and Representative Dalto, we have, I couldn't tell you right off the top of my head what the specific steps were, but I'd be happy to get you a copy of the action plan we developed as a result of the analysis and the things that were put in place to prevent this in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and I'm get it, Sandy, so the whole committee can have it.
Okay. Chairman Cruz, I'll do that.
Okay. And if I could comment on that, I'm a little bit familiar with that case, but that case, like many others, you know, a big part of it is, you know, I mean, how can airplanes crash today with the modern technology and all the double-check and fail-safe systems? And at the end of the day, most of the crashes come down to pilot error, and in this case, mm-hmm. it's probably some administrative lapse. I suppose the good thing, granted, this one was, you know, by accident, but the reason that I know about this and you know about this and the committee knows about it and Representative Dalton knows about it is because, hey, they were caught.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Not trying to be an apologist for the agency. I mean, you've got to tighten up on that.
Sure,
but one of the things that goes on is every 2 years we come into this building, we give them a whole new set of instructions, mandates, laws, and regulations to implement. And in those new instructions from the legislature comes the opportunity, if you're so inclined as an individual, to manipulate the laws. And it's tough to stay ahead of that. Yeah. I'm not saying that excuses it.
No.
But I mean, that's one of the things that goes on.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I might comment on that, you know, the point of my colleague from Tumalo is well taken, but it seems to me that we don't have enough people looking internally, irrespective of the direction that they're receiving from the legislature, to catch this. I mean, you caught one person in Tillamook or on the coast, but who knows how many occurrences or how many situations are occurring around the state. I mean, do you have an idea? Is there a guesstimate of what the loss is through employee theft, you know, from year to year?
Yeah.
Probably not. You know, if you ask a bank or an insurance company, they'll give you an estimate of fraud, but we don't have one for DHS.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's serious. You know, it's real money. $200,000 here and $200,000 there adds up to real money.
Yeah. And if I might, and I'm not going to disagree with that, Representative Dalto, but agencies come into us and we tell them we need more efficiencies, we need less administration, and to get as streamlined as they can, and it's an interesting balance to try to get there. Now, clearly, these are things that need to be addressed, but and especially in the environment currently of reorg, where there are institutional disconnects that are unavoidable. I mean, it'd be nice to know the procedures that are in place. You know, once burnt, twice shy. But you know, I don't think this is a crusade at this point. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just also like to speak in my previous life. At one point, I was in charge of the fraud detectives in Portland, Oregon. And I can tell you, private business has a lot of this also. That you never read about in the paper because these are people, because we have public we're dealing with. Of course, it's publicized. And not only don't they show up in the paper, but many times they don't even, they'll ask the police just to, once they get started, they'll just go ahead and drop out of it because they don't want the publicity.
Right.
And the bank fraud is right there. So thank you.
And Chairman Cruz, I couldn't agree with you more. I think the one thing that is critical is that we have to learn from these experiences and then put whatever we need to put in place so they won't repeat themselves.
Go ahead.
If there are no further questions,
I will turn it over to
John.
Been really excited.
Yeah, he's been chomping at the bit. He told me this morning that he was very excited about being able to come here and present to you.
And I hope you have a good report to give to your daughter.
Well, before we chair, yes. You have ordered the tape of Clyde's performance that we are going to hand deliver to his daughter to critique and then come back and present to the committee, aren't you?
I think that already done. I think it'd be a good class project.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, may I, before Clyde sits down, Clyde, I guess as we were talking about this issue and your comments, Mr. Chair, about how we ask the department to do different things every 2 years, I just have been struck with how you're cutting staff under efficiencies on page 3, staffing level same as it was in 1966, even though you have more jobs to do. And throughout this document, on page 10, you reduce the staffing level by 7 positions. Reducing on page 12, reducing project managers from 12 to 6. I just think that's amazing that you've been able to do that when, with reorganization, it must put a special strain on your department.
Chairman Cruz and Representative Tomei, I appreciate the comments, and I would say that really it's a testament to the managers and the staff in the administrative services unit, because I can safely say that one of the primary focuses that these people have is to figure out how to do things more efficiently and cost effectively, and it's really a testament to their creativity and the hard work that they've done over the years.
And I think whenever we have a new system, that it takes more work to develop that system, even if it's going to be more efficient eventually. But that you've been able to do this in these 2 years, I think is pretty remarkable.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I meant to ask this before, and I wanted to ask before you got away, Clyde, on the collections. Could you tell us, when you bring back the figures on a few of them, for instance, $17,300 of medical payment recovery out of what? $20 million? $40 million? So we know a collection percentage that you're estimating or shooting for.
Okay. Chairman Cruz and Representative Anderson, we'd be happy to send that over with the information.
So Representative, you're asking how much is owed and how much is collected?
The percentage of how much is collected to what's owed. Okay.
Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Following up on Representative Tomei's comment, I did notice the pretty substantial staffing reductions within your unit. I think that's great. My question is, are they leaving the department altogether, or are they shifting out of the administrative services section or cluster and moving to other agencies, departments within the agency? Mm-hmm.
Chairman Cruz and Representative Dalto, I think it's a mixture. We have people who are retiring. We had vacant positions we eliminated, and we had some people who, as their functions were being reduced, were given opportunities elsewhere in the department. So it's kind of a mixture of a lot of different things. We could probably, in looking at the positions we've eliminated, or reduced, kind of do some analysis and give you a count of whether it was a position elimination and they left state service or they moved into another part of the department, if you would like that.
I don't want to create extra work for you, but it's up to you.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
I think that already exists in LFO.
Yeah.
And we can walk right down there. I'll get that.
Great.
For you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, I don't want any people left out.
No, that's fine.
Oh, you're fine?
Fine.
Okay.
I just would like, well.
I knew there was something there.
I really do think it's critical for these various little departments to know personnel and operations, the budgets for each one. I think that's part of the accountability. But you said you were getting there. Only my concern.
Good morning.
It's your turn, John.
My name is John Cuddy, and I'm the Chief Information Officer for the department. And while, unlike Clyde, I have been talking to legislative committees more recently than 7 years ago, I hope you will assume I'm like him and be nice to me as well.
Was your daughter here? We are to
unfortunately, no.
You know, Clyde was smart. I mean, he prepped this thing a long ago. So.
I tried. Okay. If I might, before I start walking through my document, just to clarify a couple of things that you all talked with Clyde about. On HIPAA, the feds give us 90% funding for Medicaid development work.
Okay.
And so the stuff, especially on transactions and codes, that requires all those system changes, I think that Representative Tomei mentioned, that stuff we can get 90% funding for. What we have to do is, and part of the federal process is, we have to submit to them a thing called an advanced planning document, which is a thing that they then have to look at. We say what we want to do, what we estimate the costs are going to be, and then they put it through their system and approve it. So it's not that there's unlimited money in the sense that it's just a fund we go tap as we choose. We have to go through a mechanism in order to be able to get that 90% money.
Okay, how much of HIPAA is tied to Medicaid? I mean, it's such a blended thing.
It is, Mr. Chair, and in the definition, as Representative Westland suggested earlier, of an expanded definition of all this, we're trying to tie as much of this into Medicaid as we can. And so,
well, I mean,
to get as much 90% money by having security part of that, and so on and so forth.
Okay, I mean, you could say that Medicaid is X percent of medical costs in the state, and so you can tie that money based on that. But that's, is there a formula the feds are using, or just kind of what you present?
Not, Mr. Chair, not really. Okay. I mean, it really is if we can justify it as part of Medicaid,
okay,
and it's information systems type stuff, we can get 90% for it. And in fact, if we happen to use it for something else, like if we do some security work, and we can use it for a broader security thing, as you had suggested earlier,
right,
that's fine.
Okay.
For instance, in the safety net clinics, in which I'm thinking of computers where the screens are out, you know, right in the hallway, and there needs to be probably major changes in the structure of the clinics. Mm-hmm. Is there money for that, or more like capital improvements, or?
Mr. Chair and Representative Miles Anderson, I think the simple answer is no, in that the 90% money is for systems development and systems work. It's for creating programs and stuff around that. This would be more of a mechanical thing in the office where there need to be a rearrangement of where the screens are or where they face or that sort of thing. Now, if it were actually to go in, potentially, and I'm sort of doing this on the fly, so we'd need to check to be sure if what I'm saying is accurate, but I think potentially if we were going to change computer programs so that what was on those screens was somehow different, protected, maybe the screen went blank after 10 seconds, as I said, I'm making this up, then I think for that sort of work there's the potential to pay for that kind of computer work with 90% federal money.
So software, not hardware.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so that's one comment I wanted to make. The other one was my second whispering to Clyde that caused you, Mr. Chair, to suggest I sit up here. We have a piece of software that we implemented a number of years ago called Mobius, and the name of it doesn't matter. But what it allows us to do is to take a whole bunch of mainframe reports that had been needed to be printed and a big distribution network and getting them out to the offices and so on and so forth. Those reports are now available online. So if somebody in an office outside of Salem, or in Salem for that matter, were accustomed to getting a report on a daily, weekly, monthly, whatever, quarterly basis, in the past we would print those and distribute them. Now they can look at them online, and if they need to have a hard copy, they can print it locally. So we have, that was a thing that you had asked about, or it was possible to get some of this stuff electronically. So we are doing a pretty fair amount of that now.
Okay. How many mainframes do you have?
One.
Just one?
Yes.
You used to have two?
No, Mr. Chair, the...
Well, there was, I mean there was SSI or food stamps or something kind of had their own at one point, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. There's the Federal Disability Determination Program,
okay,
which is essentially a federal program and run by state employees, but that thing we really have no connection to. All their computer stuff, all their information technology stuff, all comes out of Washington and is tied into Washington, and that really is independent of us.
Okay.
And they have stuff that they do with all that is probably what you're thinking about, but what we have is an IBM mainframe.
Okay. So I was sure I'd seen two.
Yeah, and not,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's probably it. So if it's okay, I don't know how much time we've got, but I'll try to run through as much of this as I can for you. What I'd like to do is just try to walk through this document and give you some sense of what information technology is about in the department. I think if there are two things I'd like to help you understand today, they are, one of them is that the information technology is absolutely critical to the department's ability to operate. And without it, the department would be essentially dead in the water in its ability to provide services. The other point, and these are both on the first page in the large type there, is that the information technology operation in the department is very large and very complicated. Back to the top part of there about how essential it is to the department's operations. In this day and age, there is not any organization of any size, and we're a pretty big size, where information technology is not critical to their operation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
I'm not unclear, John, where you are.
I'm in the very first, very top of the very...
Got a new handout?
I don't seem to have... Oh, I do. I'm sorry. Thank you, John. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Another point I want to make is that information technology is not a program in itself, like food stamps or TANF or what have you. And the work that we do really is derivative of the stuff that the department does. And so what that means is that if the department has a particular program that it operates and delivers services on, like food stamps, as long as the department is in the food stamp business, it needs an information system to support it. And so the problem that you get into when you start thinking about the possibilities of reducing your resources in information technology is that you all could, and I'll take food stamps as an example, you all could decide to make, and food stamps is not a good example because it's so federally dictated, but I can still, I'll still use it as an example, and that is that if you all decided to cut the benefits of the food stamp program or in half, or the number of recipients in half, or what have you, now it might be that people doing eligibility could be reduced, maybe, but you would still need an information system to be supported to operate the food stamp program. And so the only way for a lot of these things that we could reduce this kind of staff in information technology would be if the department just went out of the food stamp business, period, and we were able to shut down that system and stop operating. You can't, it's difficult if you're going to keep this system that's one single thing intact and operational to support service delivery. You can't really chop it in half and to reflect a cutback of the number of recipients of that program. And so that's one of the difficulties we have when we try to think about how can we reduce this in response to budget cuts. as I've said here, the information technology does touch every area of DHS, and you can read that list probably easier than I can speak it. But we do go all the way from where eligibility is determined through the issuance of benefits and the payments of providers and preparing a lot of those reports that Clyde talked to you earlier that have to go to the federal government and that sort of stuff. So it really does touch every nook and cranny of the department is touched by information technology. As far as large and complex goes, this is not surprising considering that we're dealing with and supporting the most large and the most complex agency in state government. And so we really are a reflection of the complexity and the size of the department. We were one of the first to be consolidated from these seven different data processing shops. This organization was created in January of 1996. And there had been seven different data processing shops in the department, each of which made its own decisions about technology. So when I first came to the department, we had 400 or 500 Macintosh machines, for instance. I think we're down to about 30 or 40. Nothing against them, but again, if you're trying to get away from an environment that has a lot of diversity of technology, and I'm going to talk about that a little more in a minute, having 400 or 500 Macs and a whole bunch of PCs as well is very difficult to support and to get them to work together. And so each of these divisional data processing or information technology operations made its own decisions about what PCs to buy, what software to put on them, what software to develop to support their operations, what tools they use to develop that software, and so on and so forth. And so what we've really inherited is a very, very non-standard, technically complex operation because of all those decisions that were made for the previous 25 years or so by the individual divisions. Since then, we've been working to try to create standards and move toward a more standard environment. I'm going to talk again about that in a minute, to figure out ways to improve services, improve efficiency, and all that kind of stuff that you have an opportunity to do if you can get these groups together and create more of a more useful critical mass than some of these different separate organizations had before the consolidation. Since 1996, we've had a couple of additional rounds of consolidation because not everything was brought into this central thing in January of 1996. And over time, we've been bringing both staff and budget that was left out in the divisions to do various things into this central operation. A critical thing for us, and this really ties in with what I said a moment ago about the fact that that our work is derived from the work of the department, and that is we are driven by what I call customer business needs. And I don't decide this stuff. I used to be a customer in other human services agencies of information technology, and I vowed when I came here that I wasn't going to have this IT shop behave the way I've seen them behave in the past when I've been on the receiving end. The way I used to say it over the years is that the IT people have had a history of being what I call the keepers of the mysteries. You know, they sit back here and say, well, maybe we'll let you do this, maybe we'll let you do that. And it used to drive me crazy as a customer, and I vowed as a supplier of IT services I wasn't going to do that. So we've really made an effort since this thing was formed to make sure that what we respond to is the business needs of our customers. And we get those business needs that get translated into requirements for systems, some of them from you all. I think one of you mentioned earlier that I think it was Representative Westman was talking about every 2 years you do stuff that we have to respond to. We also, of course, have improvements in business practices that the people in our programs find and ask us to implement for them, and then we get, like with HIPAA and other stuff, we get requirements that come from the federal government that we have to comply with as well. The non-standard technical environment that we inherited that I mentioned earlier is expensive to support. I'm on to page two now. It's expensive to support. It's not as reliable as it should be because if something breaks and you've got somebody who doesn't know a particular thing that we inherited because they've been trained in something else. It takes longer to fix it, and it's harder to keep it up. I can just tell you one story, try to make this a little bit real. The set of software that is put on a personal computer, and I'm trying to speak English here, and stop me if I don't. Please interrupt me if I don't speak English. But the set of software that goes on a personal software is referred to as an image. And so if you had the Microsoft products, Word and Excel and stuff like that, on one PC, that would be one image. If you had the Corel products, WordPerfect and Quattro Pro and that sort of stuff on another PC, that would be a different image. Mm-hmm. And we had a local support person who's based in LeGrand, who covers, I think, three counties in that part of the state. And he used to carry around 10 CDs, each with a different image, because he didn't know when he went to work on a PC what he was going to find. And sometimes, I'm told, even those 10 weren't sufficient, that he would have to tweak one of them in order to make it fit the image that he found on the PC that he was trying to fix. That is unbelievably inefficient and makes for some really, ultimately, some pretty bad service. And that's the kind of diversity of technology that we've inherited, that we're slowly but surely trying to squeeze that variability out of how we deliver our services. And then the other problem, and this is especially related to a non-standard technical environment, and this is especially true when we're trying to work on service integration and better collaboration around the delivery of services, is because of all of these systems that were developed by the divisions over the years and all these applications to meet their siloed or stovepipe business needs, they don't talk to each other very well. And it is very difficult to share information horizontally across these programs so that somebody who's working in child welfare and wants to know if there's a mental health problem or if there's a alcohol and drug abuse problem or whatever, setting aside confidentiality, which of course is always in the picture, just the mechanics of trying to get data across those, horizontally across those programs, is very difficult because the stuff was developed in a silo, and the definitions of the data are different, and the way it's constructed are different, and it is not easy to share. So that's another sort of detriment we have with having this non-standard technical environment. I just put down here in the middle of page two a few statistics to try to give you a sense of the size of this thing. We've got 9,500 personal computers. Representative Cruz mentioned the mainframe. We have a large mainframe that operates every day, all day. We have about 400, I should say, what are called servers, which are mid-range computers that do a number of things. Let me think. I won't go into what they are. If you want me to give you more detail, an example
would be good.
An example?
Yeah.
Some of our newer systems are what are called client-server systems, and client-server is a architecture, if you will, that has as part of it what are called clients, which are usually personal computers. Those are the clients in the client-server architecture. And then there's a server, which is a bigger computer that acts as a data cop, if you will, that helps the data move around between those personal computers. And it often, when you send stuff in from the personal computer into the server, which is not a mainframe, although a mainframe could be a big server, the server in the client-server architecture handles that data and may pass it on to the mainframe or receive data from the mainframe and pass it back to the client, which is the PC. And we have a bunch of those. We have a lot of our newer applications that now run statewide, Trax, FACES, Oregon Access, Orca, are all what are called client-server applications, which have servers at the center of them. They still relate to mainframe systems, but they have these servers that relate to them. We also have servers in every one of our offices that are called file and print servers, and what they do is they operate the local network in the office, and they move files around between local PCs in the office, and they also handle printing and send print jobs to the printer and do that sort of thing. And we've got all over the state something in the order of 400 servers of various sizes that do those various kinds of jobs.
Okay, and as an example, field office, you got two people, they've each got their own PC. If I'm going to mail something to Representative Wesson, it goes through there.
Yes.
Okay, and you're talking about the print function that goes through there,
yes,
too?
Yes. Yes, actually, Mr. Chair, if you were going to mail something to Representative Westland, it would go through the server and into the mail post office and then back out to him, because it has to go through the email software, which is central. But it still would go through the server and then back out on the network here in Salem and then back out.
Okay, so the email is not part of the server, but the server is the conduit?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. $6,600 computer programs that we run, mostly on the mainframe, with 13 million lines of code on the mainframe, computer code. We produce 580,000 checks and vouchers every month.
Just a minute. You don't have 6,600 programs, but you've got you've got 6,600 computer programs, but DHS doesn't administer 6,600 programs. Why so many?
They are computer programs. Well, because an information system will consist of a bunch of programs, of individual programs that do specific things, and so you may have something that runs every day, where you do overnight running of what's called batch processing, which is the overnight stuff that does our production runs, that produces checks. And so you might have, this is vastly oversimplified, mostly so I can keep it straight, you may have a program or a set of programs that run every day. And you'll notice the last item here is we have 3,300 computer programs that run each night. Those are all those daily runs that may produce checks, but then you may have another program as part of that system that at the end of the month produces the end of the month report and the statistics on what happened in each of those daily runs. So you'll have a group of computer programs that will comprise or make up one particular so-called application like Oregon Access or Trax or some of the mainframe things like MMIS or CMS or some of those.
Okay, so basically a program is a set of code that performs a function.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And then the other thing that's the next to last bullet here is we have 7 million approximately computer transactions every day. And these are mostly online. These are online transactions where people are coming in and asking for information or submitting information that gets stored, or making changes in people's addresses or whatever. We have 7 million of those a day that come in, mostly into the mainframe, into these client-server systems. Major activities, and some of this I've implied already, is that we maintain our existing applications and we develop new ones. Many of our applications are very old, very creaky. Some of them are as old as 30 years. These are the mainframe systems. They were developed, as I said earlier, to meet the needs of individual human services programs. Many of the older ones were developed when technology was different, when standards for development were different. They're not as well documented as they ought to be. They've been patched a lot over the years because every time you or the federal government or the people who operate these systems and want to have a change to improve something or change something, we have to go in and change the program. They are very difficult to maintain because they are so old and they have been patched so much over so many decades, some of them.
How old is the hardware of your mainframe?
Approximately 2 years old.
So it's relatively okay.
Yes. Well, actually, I'm going to come to that in a minute when I talk about some of the impact of budget reductions. We're at a point where we need a mainframe upgrade, and we're not sure we can afford it.
Okay.
And I'll talk about that in a moment. We also have some newer systems that I mentioned, some of these statewide client server systems, Access, Trax, ORCA and FACES being the four main ones. And even though those systems have added newer functions, they still rely on interfacing with the mainframe and getting data from the old systems on the mainframe. One of the problems you have with information technology, and part of this is a function of cost, because it is just amazingly expensive to have to think about replacing some of these things, is very little goes away. You know, if I have a car that's 20 years old, and I might give it to my son or to Clyde's daughter. But,
he's trying to score points.
I'm trying to help him.
Pointing you to my app.
But if I have a car that's 20 years old and I want to replace it, I get rid of it. If you have a computer system that's 20 years old and you want to improve its functionality and you build something in front of it, like a client-server system, you don't replace it. What you end up doing is layering this stuff on top of old stuff, and it makes it very complicated, and part of the problem is it's expensive, very expensive, to go in and replace these things. We're in a project now to replace our Medicaid Management Information System, the MMIS system, and that could end up costing $100 million before we're done. Now, I'm hastening to add that that's pretty much 90% federal, but still it's a lot of money. It's public money, and wherever it comes from, it's ultimately ours. So that's one thing that we do, is we maintain the existing applications and we develop new ones. Another thing we do is all of our network stuff. We have a wide area network that connects the offices around the state to each other. We have local area networks in each office that connect people to each other through that server. And then we support all that, and we also support those 9,500 personal computers and all the printers that are attached and that sort of stuff. So that's another major activity that we have. Moving to page three, we operate a central mainframe and a group of central servers that some of those client-server applications like Access Tracts, et cetera, reside on here in Salem, and that's all in our computer center a few blocks away from here. Another thing that we do is we have a lot of projects throughout our organization. We have projects to develop systems and to make major enhancements to them. We have projects to install software statewide, and we've really tried to develop a project culture in the department, or in this organization, I should say. One of the main things that I think is just great that the Department of Administrative Services has done here over the last 4 or 5 years is they have, and I think some of this was the response, for those of you who've been around a bit, to a number of the system's failures that got a lot of notoriety in the early and mid-1990s. The Department of Administrative Services put together a program to improve project management in the state, and I think it's been enormously successful. They've offered training and methodologies in project management. We've sent a lot of people to them, done a lot of training in that area, and I think that's been one of the major contributors to the fact that there haven't been any major failures in our agency as well as in others since they started doing that, and I applaud DAS for putting that together. Because we do so many projects, our staffing levels fluctuate. So if you take a snapshot of how many people we've got at any particular time, it's going to be a combination of permanent staff, limited duration staff, temporary staff, and contractors, many of whom work on projects, and then when the project's done, most of them go away, and maybe another project starts and people come, and so our staffing levels go up and down with additions and subtractions of a number of those kinds of positions that are related to all the project activity that we do, especially around new development. The last half of page three, I'm trying to move along here pretty quickly because I know your time is in. If I'm going too fast, please tell me. I just put down some things. I think that one of the things that we all need to understand is that information technology in this department is significantly under-resourced. And I realize I used to manage human services programs, and I realized that there's always this conflict between what I'll loosely call infrastructure, whether it's putting roofs on buildings or buying new personal computers, and the need to deliver services to disadvantaged people here in the state. And so often, when those decisions are made, your infrastructure takes a backseat, and often that's entirely appropriate from my perspective. But what it means is that we We are significantly under-resourced. I've tried to just put a few statistics down here. In the United States, the first dark bullet there, the average state agency out of $100 budgeted spent $4.10 on IT. Our department spends $1.30. The second big bullet, the average state agency, 7 out of every 50 employees work in IT. In our department, it's 2 out of every 50 work in IT. Looking down at the last bullet, if you look at a comparison with government agency organizations of a similar size to ours, and that is about 10,000 employees, on our centralized help desk, we spend about 15% of what others spend. We spend for end-user support about 25%, and you can read the rest of it, but I think you get the idea. Moving on to page 4, all this stuff, these comparative numbers come from Gartner Group, which is a international company that is recognized as a kind of a leader in doing research and industry forecasting and consulting work, and so these numbers are I believe, pretty solid from our source. Just quickly to talk about major initiatives, I just put down 3 to give you some sense of some of the stuff we're working on. Of course, the big one I mentioned a minute ago is the Medicaid Management Information System replacement. We have an outdated mainframe system that we transferred in 1982 from another state, and it was already old when we got it in 1982. And it is now no longer meeting, in many, many parts of it, meeting federal requirements for certification, which we have to have if we have a Medicaid program in this state. And we've had a project going on now this is the second biennium we've been working on this thing. And we've done our business requirements, and they are being used, interestingly, as a model for other states by the federal government because they've been so impressed with what we've done, and they think we're kind of one of the leaders now on kind of a new round of these MMIS systems. And we're now gearing up to do a procurement to transfer a system from another state that will come as close as possible to meeting our needs. We don't want to build one from scratch. It's too risky, too expensive, and it's much safer and much easier to take one from another state, modify it somewhat to meet our needs, and put it in place and start using it. We're also going to be outsourcing some of the things that we currently outsource, like the pharmacy point of sale and the surveillance and utilization review subsystem called DSSURS. Those are currently outsourced, and we would continue to outsource those pieces of it, and then the other parts we would transfer in from another state and modify.
What other state?
Not sure yet.
Not sure yet.
We have 3 or 4 possibilities, still looking, still thinking, still trying to figure out how they work.
Okay.
That's part of the process we're engaged in right now.
Okay.
This project is about 90% federal. I always say about 90% federal because there's a few things on these projects the feds won't pay 90% for, like training and office rent. Don't ask me why, but they don't. So we say 90%, it works out to, depending on the nature of the project, 89% or something like that. We're expecting this project to finish this thing. I don't have firm dates yet. Probably going to take another 4 to 6 years. This is a long, involved thing. It is very expensive, and we're going to do it right. And to do it right, we're not going to rush into it and slam something in and take a chance of having a major failure. Another one that we've been working on is called Express, which is a system that makes payments for developmentally disabled, some mental health, and some alcohol and drug services. About $800 million a biennium goes through this payment process, and the system that's being used now is rubber bands and paper clips. It is partly manual. It uses a thing called RBase, which is an old database that has been gone for years, an old personal computer database that's gone for years. Because of the Staley settlement, There's an expectation of a major increase in payments that are going to have to be made by this. The payments today are already are made late, like 90 days or something, to make these payments. And so the department just decided we had to replace it because this old rubber band and paperclip thing wasn't going to cut it with all the volume coming in from Staley. And so we've had that going on. We have not gotten that done as quickly as we'd hoped because we had some trouble hiring people. Finally got our staff hired. We're expecting to complete the major part of that about 15 months from now, and with some reporting and some other stuff done by December of next year. And that also is part of Medicaid. It's part of MMIS, even though it's a separate system, and we've got 90% federal funding for that as well. The third one I just want to mention is the new WIC system that replaces a mainframe system. I put the acronym at the end of all of these. This supports the Women, Infants, and Children's Nutrition Program. It's 100% federal money, and we just this last month went into pilot, and it mostly will be operated by county health departments. And we expect to have, after our pilot and expanding the thing statewide and doing whatever changes we need to make after what we learn from our pilot, we expect to have that completed then statewide December of this year.
Question.
As I said, that's all federal.
Representative Morris Anderson.
Thank you. What about the immunizations database? Does that coordinate with WIC, or is WIC now totally standalone?
Mr. Chair and Representative Monis Anderson, there is a conceptual model that public health has called the Women and Children's Health Data System. I think that's right. Sorry.
Woodchuck is what I always called it.
Yeah.
I couldn't remember it.
Yes, that is how it's pronounced. You're right. That has a number of components to it, of which immunization is one. This is another one.
And so this would be a part.
Several other that they're trying to make compatible with each other. Now, how integrated that's ultimately going to end up being when they get all that finished and kind of tied together, I think, is a little bit up in the air. But they are immunization, and this and a couple of other things are all part of that concept.
Yeah, just follow. That was the one frustrating thing is the feds wanted this WIC, this TWIST model, or I'm not sure how it came. And then we have other data systems where we're tracking. And so there's like double data entry on so many of these things that,
yes,
which I would hope that we would try to eliminate.
We are trying very hard to get away from that. One of the things I can tell you is that if you think we're stovepipes, the federal government makes us look like pikers. I mean, the federal government is unbelievably stovepipe. If you want to get a system that serves several different federal programs, they will sit for months and occasionally years arguing about what they call cost allocation. Who's going to pay what piece? Is food stamps going to pay 23.59% of the cost or 23.54% of the cost? I mean, it gets that bad. It is just enormously frustrating for the states to deal with this because they are so stovepipe and they don't talk to each other and they don't work together. And what you've just described is a good example of that.
If we were to integrate immunization with TWIST, do we run into any HIPAA concerns there?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. That's a good question. I'm not sure.
That's going into medical, so.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. I'm not sure. We'll make sure we.
that would be called unintended consequences.
Yes, certainly would.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
That's HIPAA costing us money right now because we took John's time, the committee's time, your time to answer that. That's HIPAA costing us bucks right now.
Yeah.
And if I could suggest, Mr. Chair, if you'd all like to fill out a timesheet, we can try to get 90%. this half hour of your time.
Well, I tell you, unfortunately, the amount we make, it wouldn't be much. So.
there are two more sections. I don't know, again, about how much time you want to spend here today, but there are two more sections. I put together some stuff about some of the efficiencies we've gotten from consolidation and also impact of budget cuts on us. And so we're...
The budget, we're going to leave the budget to Ways and Means at this point in time. We're just trying to get a feel for the new critter. And... And I think we don't necessarily need to go in there. We do need to go to the floor, and I've got to be there on time today because I got to do the flag salute. But,
well, if you'd like...
And it's an honor to do the flag salute.
If you'd like more at any time, of course, I'd, as always, be happy to come back and help you in any way I can.
No, I appreciate this information. It's been very helpful. Is there anything else, committee? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. It's been... a pleasure, hasn't it?
It has.
Okay.
Very much so.
Okay. And with that, I will close the informational meeting, and we are adjourned. Good.